Are we exposed? This is what every security team is wondering. But with vulnerabilities scattered across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos, the truth is out of reach, and attackers know it. There's a better way. Unify to defy risk with Tenable AI-powered exposure management. Tenable brings together all your security data and exposures in one unified view, giving you the attacker's map and revealing the critical paths and weaknesses they can exploit. Now your teams can prioritize intelligently, move decisively, and collaborate without friction. Tenable turns scattered work into a single proactive force. Instead of chasing noise, your team knows where to focus, gaining clarity, control, and speed to reduce cyber risk with confidence. Learn more at tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here. Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Jurors in the box.
Ms. Douglas, does the defense have any more evidence?
No, Your Honor. The defense rests.
All right. Mr. Benyazin, any rebuttal evidence?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this concludes the evidentiary portions of the trial. The attorneys and I are going to work on the jury instructions for the rest of the afternoon. There's no need for you to stay for that. So I'm going to release you and remind you that tomorrow is Election Day and encourage everyone here and out there to vote. I do need to give you two specific instructions about your recess and tomorrow. We are recessing now for our evening break. I ask that you be back in the jury room at 11 a.m. on Wednesday. All right. During this recess, you are not to begin the discussion of any of the aspects of this case. Upon your return, you are requested to go immediately to your jury check-in room in the main building and do not hang around the halls. You are not to engage in any conversation with any of the parties, the witnesses, the attorneys, or any of the spectators, including the media. You are not to go to the scene of the case or undertake any independent investigation. I will have specific instructions for you on that in a moment. No one should approach you and discuss this matter, and you should not remain within the hearing distance of anyone discussing any aspect of this case. Of course, that includes viewing any newspapers or television or listening to the radio. Only election coverage for you folks tomorrow. You must also leave your notepads and any notes you have taken with my sheriff. If you are approached by anyone concerning your jury service during the course of this trial, you should make that fact known to my sheriff 11 a.m. on Wednesday. Additionally, ladies and gentlemen, I have previously advised you, and I did just again, that you are not to go to the scene of this case. Richneck Elementary is a polling location. If any member of the jury votes at that polling place, you are instructed not to go anywhere other than the location of the polling boxes. Do not undertake any action to view the scene or investigate for yourselves any location described during the trial of this case. All right. Thank you very much. Vote, and I will see you Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Be seated. Any motions on behalf of the defense?
Yes, Your Honor, Judge. The defense would have a renewed motion to strike. I'll keep this brief. First of all, I would expressly incorporate all prior arguments I've raised during the initial motion to strike. I would also expressly incorporate by reference all prior arguments I raised on the related motion for summary judgment, motion and motion for a special plea, sovereign immunity, as well as the related briefs and oral argument on the same. At this stage, Judge, I just want to highlight and emphasize a few pieces of evidence that can affect the court's analysis at this stage. First and foremost is we talked about evidence of duty and breach of duty. And here, where there is sole theory is that there's an assumed duty to exercise reasonable care for another's protection, to protect them from third-party harm, that duty, that undertaking has got to be expressed. We've hit this a million times. The court is well familiar with the case law on that point. What is different is that now we have the plaintiff's answers to requests for admission that were admitted. They are unchallenged. They are dispositive and established conclusively in this case. One of the answers in response to a request for admission was that was no to the question whether or not Dr. Parker ever made an express promise or agreement to protect Ms. Warner, either on the day of the incident, on January 6, 2023, or before. That should be dispositive, Judge, under the case law. That should be dispositive because under Terry versus Irish Fleet, there must be an expressly communicated, an express communication of a specifically described undertaking to protect another from third-party criminal harm. That is completely absent in this case, and now we have Ms. Warner's explicit admission on that point. And not only admission, but one that is binding and conclusive as a matter of law. In addition, Judge, I want to highlight that when it comes to establishing the three potential prongs under the restatement, in addition to duty, breach, proximate cause, etc., they need to establish one of three of these possible avenues for relief under restatement, second of torts, section 324A. And the first is either Dr. Parker's breach increased the risk of harm or induced reliance by the plaintiff to her detriment, or alternatively, that Dr. Parker assumed a duty that a third party owed Ms. Warner. On the final point, as before, I just want to emphasize that portion of this doctrine, that particular prong, has no application in this case. That is, if you look at the restatement, section 324 in the comments, it explains that that typically applies where there's an express contract or agreement to undertake obligations by some entity. And usually, almost all those situations are, it's like a security force, private security force saying, look, this business has a duty to protect its patrons. We are going to outsource this responsibility to you by contract. Sign on the dotted line. You agree to provide these services for us that we are obligated to do. And then you can be on the hook that way. That's completely absent in this case. I've heard no evidence to establish that the theory, that particular prong, has any application here. In addition, evidence of reliance. We've talked about this previously, but it bears emphasis that although in the restatement it only uses the language reliance, the case law interpreting it has added specific requirements. The first is Age versus Church of God in Christ, which explicitly says the reliance must be justifiable. And then Terry versus Irish Fleet, as well as Didato versus Strayer and others, have repeatedly said that not only must it be justifiable, but it must also be detrimental. And that matters here, Judge, because although there is not a significant amount of assumption of duty case law interpreting that language in that specific context, there's ample authority applying those terms in other contexts of the law. This is something that transcends the just tort doctrine. It applies in equitable estoppel. It applies in fraud cases. Lots of cases have talked about what is reasonable reliance, what is justifiable reliance, what is detrimental reliance. And what it boils down to, Judge, is that, look, in this case, first and foremost, there can be no reliance as a matter of law where the party who's asserting reliance, saying that I relied on somebody's express assurances that they're going to protect me, there cannot be any reasonable reliance as a matter of law where that person either knows the true facts or has equivalent access to obtain those true facts. To make that concrete, a good example was illustrated in the Nolde case. Nolde was the hand-waving case that's cited in Terry. There's a motorist driving, go ahead, cross the street. They get hit by an oncoming vehicle. There was no there's no assumption of an undertaking there. There was no reasonable reliance in that case because they examined, look, what did the pedestrian know at the time that they were crossing the street? And they said, well, there, they were in a position where they could see the oncoming traffic. Not only could they see the oncoming traffic in the imminent danger, they also could see and observe that the motorist himself was not in a position to ascertain or assure anybody's safety because they couldn't see oncoming traffic. So in that circumstance, it would be unreasonable as a matter of law to say, I'm on notice, I can see there's a car coming, there's a guy over here that I can see who can't see what's going on, this guy's saying go ahead. It would be unreasonable as a matter of law for me to proceed knowing what I know. That has some application in this case, Judge, because a fair inference for the evidence is that, taken as true with all inferences flowing to the plaintiff, there are cases that there were repeated reports to Dr. Parker that there's a firearm, we need to act now. That's their theory, that's their case. And if that's the case, the people who are asserting that, who are providing these reports, were the first responders. They were the people who were on scene, they were closest to the action, they heard the initial reports. Ms. Amy Kovac heard the reports from two students saying that there might be a gun in this child's backpack. There was Ms. Jennifer West, who interviewed R about his statements and his interaction with JT, who was a student they all suspected might have a firearm now on his person at that stage. And all these people, including West, Kovac, Sims, Rawls, all these folks, they had firsthand knowledge about what was going on. And none of these people could have relied on any assurances made by Dr. Parker as a matter of law. There were no assurances made. We've heard that from the RFAs. But even if that were the case, there couldn't be reasonable reliance as a matter of law, given what these parties knew, given what they've come into court and said we knew at the time. In addition, Judge, related to that, there is a thread of case law that establishes reliance may also be unreasonable as a matter of law where somebody undertakes an investigation to ascertain the true facts. I will acknowledge that that's usually confined to the context of property transactions where someone's a sophisticated buyer, and if they undertake any investigation to ascertain any defects in the property or title, etc., then it will be imputed to them. Hey, if you have followed through on that investigation, you would have found out. So you can't rely on the seller's assurances. So I'll acknowledge with respect to that piece, Judge, that's a little bit more tenuous. But overall, the principle that you cannot have reasonable reliance as a matter of law where you know the true facts, have the same access to the person you're relying on, is no good. The other piece, Judge, is that when it comes to detrimental reliance, that's something that comes from Terry and Didato. You've heard about this repeatedly, but it's important here because even in the restatement, they talk about how detrimental reliance is kind of the crux of the assumption of duty doctrine. That's kind of where it all started. Even outside of the third-party criminal harm context, that's usually the types of cases you get. Somebody makes some sort of representation, and there's reliance to your detriment based on that. If you look at the restatement and it talks about what that means, what that looks like, you'd have to establish at least a couple things. The first is that Dr. Parker's representations, which I again do not concede, they did not exist here, but to the extent that there were representations, they induced the plaintiff to rely on them and induced her to forego taking safety precautions that she otherwise would have done for her own safety. And we've heard from Ms. Warner, and she testified, and at no point did she testify or suggest or imply that but for the information she received from Dr. Parker or anybody else, she would have called 911, isolated the student, detained him, searched the student, taken any other reasonable safety precautions that Dr. Klinger has talked about. She's not testified to that. There is a gap in the evidence. There's a gap in the evidence that they were required to establish, and the jury can't fill it in. They can't fill it in through speculation. And given that circumstance, Judge, you'd have to strike the case. You'd have to strike that case because there is no evidence whatsoever of any detrimental reliance. In addition, Judge, the third alternative avenue of relief here is they can try to establish that Dr. Parker's, again, to the extent she made any representations, that those increased the risk of harm. That's a more nebulous standard, Judge. There's not a lot of case law talking about that explicitly. But what you see in the comments is that basically someone made a promise or agreement, which again, no evidence of that whatsoever, but someone makes a promise or agreement, and then because of that promise or agreement, somebody ends up worse off. Again, it's more nebulous, but I just want to highlight and caution for the court that that increase the risk standard does not substitute or supplant proximate cause. Proximate cause is still always going to be at issue. I just want the court to be aware of that. When it comes to that problem, though, I would contend, Judge, that there's been no evidence whatsoever establishing the extent to which, if any, Dr. Parker's representations or assurances or conduct or statements in any way increase the risk of harm in this case. By all accounts, and it sounds like this was a unprecedented, unforeseeable event. No one, including all the witnesses that came in here and were paraded into court, identified Dr. Parker, accused her of what we're here in court for today. All of those people themselves acknowledged that this was unforeseeable. And given that circumstance, you cannot establish that there was an increased risk of harm based on anything she did or did not do. Lastly, Judge, I'll just hit home here when it comes to gross negligence. I know you've heard me say it, I'll say it again. This is an indifferent standard, not an inadvertence or carelessness standard. And that's crucial here, Judge, because there's been no evidence of actual indifference to repeated or reports from these parties that there might be a threat on campus. You've heard the opposite. Perhaps initially you've heard from some of the witnesses testifying. For example, Ms. Warner testified that when she initially came into Dr. Parker's office and reported some misbehavior in the cafeteria, there was no reference at this stage of a firearm. This was a separate incident. There was no knowledge of that threat at that stage. But her testimony was that Dr. Parker did not look up, did not respond. Amy Kovac also testified similarly. However, even Amy Kovac testified that while she was in the room and witnessed that exchange, she said Dr. Parker, after Ms. Warner was on her way out the door, Dr. Parker turns to Kovac and directs her, let Ms. Warner know that if she's uncomfortable, if there's any continued misbehavior by that student, she has authority to pick up the phone and call that student's parent to pick him up early. And that had been their practice up to that point. Whenever there's been misconduct or misbehavior by that student, typically they would call the parents or they would call for assistance to isolate, take care of that kid, or get him back to home with their parents. That wasn't done in this case. That's important, Judge, because that shows that there's arguably at least the exercise of some degree of care. There's ongoing responses to each of these reports. There's also communication and action by Dr. Parker in response. And this is highlighted by Amy Kovac, of all people. Her testimony was that at one stage when she came in, she initially maintained that all by herself, she decided to search this backpack. She got the idea all by herself. She went in there, put on her detective hat, opened up the backpack, and searches for a firearm, doesn't find anything. But she also couldn't help herself in her testimony. She acknowledged that when she spoke to Dr. Parker, she said, well, yeah, I told her I intended to go and search that backpack. And Ms. Toscano asked her, well, how did she respond? And she said Dr. Parker nodded. She nodded her assent. And the question that was posed to Amy Kovac at that stage was, did you receive any response or, quote, direction, or were directed? And so it's in that context that she was testifying, explaining that I put the assistant principal on notice that I intended to search this backpack because of a potential threat that it might contain a weapon. And in response, she nodded. And so arguably, that constitutes assent. That is not just someone independently, without not the administrator's knowledge, going in and undertaking an investigation. That is essentially seeking authorization to do so. And if that's the case, that's the exercise of, that is the exercise of at least some degree of care. It's not indifference. So, Judge, for those bases, on all those grounds and those stated previously, I ask the court respectfully to strike the charge with prejudice.
Ms. Spinelli?
Your Honor, this argument is duplicative, I think, of what was heard at halftime. In fact, even the evidentiary backing of it is relying upon the plaintiff's case in chief and rather than the defendant's case in chief. And so for the reasons that we previously argued on the motion to strike at halftime, I'd ask that we be able to expressly assume those so I don't have to repeat myself.
All right, those will be incorporated.
And then, obviously, we disagree on the state of the law, so I just point this out on the issue of Burns v. Gagnon and express duties. There is nothing in the Burns v. Gagnon case that reflects a statement from the assistant principal, Burns, to the student, Gagnon. And yet, the court still found the assumed duty of care was appropriate and that it was a finding that the jury needed to make, both as to what was assumed and whether it was breached. And this position that these RFAs are somehow dispositive of some material issue is directly rebutted by the Burns case, and then again in the Terry versus Irish Fleet case, to the extent it discusses it, talks about express undertakings, recognizing it's not from person A to person B. That's not the legal requirement, even in the case of Terry versus Irish Fleet, which we think is inapplicable because of the third-party crime context that we discussed previously. And so for the same reasons we argued previously, we've met our burden. Certainly a reasonable jury can conclude that both an assumed duty was met either in either three prongs of 324A of the restatement, which was incorporated by Burns v. Gagnon, and then ultimately when we get to the question of the breach of the duty and whether that breach amounted to gross negligence, our view is any indifference, that is, the foreseeability is for the jury to decide, but even their expert conceded foreseeability of that threat, that any action that or inaction that was taken by Dr. Parker in and of itself was demonstrative of indifference, but that's ultimately a jury issue. And we get to this issue of cumulative conduct, which is referenced in the Chapman versus City of Virginia Beach case, which we also think meets the burden as it relates to gross negligence. And so for the reasons we stated previously, for these reasons, we think the burden has been met appropriately at this stage to let the jury and the finders of fact decide this case.
Judge, if I made two quick points to address novel issues raised. The first is, I want to clarify the nature of my argument. My argument with respect to an express undertaking communicated by Dr. Parker to anybody, that is not, the nature of my argument is not that there's been no evidence that Dr. Parker directly conveyed a message to the plaintiff. That is important. But more important than that is that there was no express communication whatsoever of a specifically described undertaking to protect anyone, much less the plaintiff. All of this is based on tacit assurances. All of this is based on implied conduct. All of this is based on implication that has been categorically rejected by the court in Terry versus Irish Fleet. So I acknowledge that in Burns, Judge, this is worth paying attention to. In Burns, they did have a statement from the principal. It was not to the plaintiff, but it was to the student who came to the principal's office and said, look, this student at the school, there's going to be a fight later today with this student. And in response, unlike in this case, in this response, the assistant principal there expressly said, I will look into it. I'm going to check into this. That was the legal hook that the appellate court seized upon and said, look, that is something that creates a jury issue. That's something where they can figure out, hey, by saying I'm going to look into that and then failing to follow through on that representation, that's what gets you over the finish line. That's what gets you in front of a jury. That's what gets you an express undertaking, potentially. Here, there's been no response from Dr. Parker. They've never said that she's ever said or explicitly said, yes, I'm going to get right on that. Yes, I will take that up. Yes, I'm going to look into this. It has all just been applied through voluntary conduct.
All right, for the reasons previously stated, the court finds that the plaintiff has met their burden at this time, and the matter shall go to a jury. All right, we're ready to begin with jury instructions.
Yes, Your Honor. How would you like to begin?
Great question, Mr. Binion. All right. So the way that I had it organized was I have the stack of agreed. So we've all got that stack, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And obviously, we'll put together a final stack for everyone to double check, but I've got that stack. All right. Next, what I've done is I've gone with defendants offered instructions that are lettered, and then I put your matching or similar to those in order as well, and we can discuss those at the same time. And if I've missed anything, then you can correct me and say, no, we need to discuss this, if that makes sense, Mr. Benninghausen.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, so let's go with defendants offered instruction A. All right, offered and then objected to with, it looks like two different versions offered, Mr. Benninghausen, if I'm correct.
We have, I look at them as the finding instruction, and then there's the, I forget how the Virginia model talks about it. But the one that I think competes is your verdict must be based on the facts as you find them. Is that what you're looking at the
correct
top?
I've got two versions from your side. No, I don't. I'm sorry. So I have one that starts, your verdict must be based on the facts, right, as you find them, et cetera. And then I also had one that was very similar. You shall find your verdict for the plaintiff if she is proved. Does that go to a different...
Those are two different model instructions. I don't always think that they're both necessary, but we've proffered both.
Okay, but that would go in the same place of this one, correct? Do you agree with that?
It would go, I think that your verdict must be based on the facts as you find them, is competing with their instruction A.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So state your objections to defendant's instruction A.
Yes, Judge. I think to start, it's voluminous and confusing. Second, I think that when we get into what we must prove, in other words, there's a whole paragraph that's not contained in the VMJI, that's the second paragraph, that talks about what must be proven. A, we don't agree with that recitation of the law, which is also discussed elsewhere in other instructions. But B, this is simply a finding instruction. That's why the VMJI has it, which is to say these are the issues for you to decide. It's not to actually give them legal instruction on how to apply the law to those issues. It's just to say these are the issues. And then the instructions later will tell them how to decide the issue at bar. And so that entire second paragraph is impermissible in our view in a finding instruction, and it doesn't recite the law as it is applicable here. So then we get to, accordingly, the issues in this case are as follows. And again, I think it breaks down the issues for the jury to decide in a much more complex and drawn out manner as compared to what they're going to decide. The issues here are, was she grossly negligent? And was that gross negligence a proximate cause of the damages? Now, I understand that there's going to be argument as to whether or not contributory negligence should go to the jury. We don't think that issue's been properly established to go to the jury, and so we would argue that at that stage. But there is, you know, seven prongs or little subsections here where the model gives us two or three to go off of.
All right. And, you know, and I guess I just want to lay out, you know, the Supreme Court has made it clear what our standards of review are for these instructions. One is it a correct statement of law? And then two, is there a scintilla of evidence to support that instruction? So I just wanted to couch that for everyone as how I'm framing each of these jury instructions. All right, go ahead.
I understand, Your Honor. First, with respect to the first point, I understand the counsel takes issue with the recitation of the law included in this instruction. This may be something where perhaps we can circle back to this when we discuss the other instructions that go into detail about. So I'll leave that to the court. But I would contend that this is an accurate rendition of the law as it stands today. And I would also take issue with counsel's characterization of this as a finding instruction. In the proposed instructions we compiled, Judge, I've seen many attorneys have two separate instructions where they're basically bookends to them. And at the front, it says you need to follow the law and instructions as provided here. And then it will just lay out the potential issues. Later on, there will be a bookend instruction, which will be the actual finding instruction that will say, look, you must find for the plaintiff if X, Y, and Z are satisfied. We included both of those in our proposed instructions. They weren't duplicative. So I just want to draw that distinction. The other thing, Judge, is I do understand I'm sensitive to the fact that especially in a case like this, you don't want to be overburden the jury with complicated instructions. You don't want them to be too voluminous. You don't want them to be convoluted. But the nature of some of the case law here and some of the principles require some explanation. And without that additional explanation, and I will highlight it as we go along, they would be incomplete and misleading instructions. That is another principle that is well settled in the case law. To be an accurate statement of the law, it must also be complete. It must fairly cover all issues, is the language they use. So just highlighting that from the outset, that at first blush, yes, this can seem like a lot, but this case does have multiple issues, and this is an accurate statement of the law. In terms of, I understand counsel arguing, I've seen this in many cases as well, when you frame the issues, you just say, look, two issues, right? Were they contributory negligent, and was that the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries? I hear what they're saying, I understand that, there's an intuitive appeal to that. One problem with that, Judge, is I would contend that the proximate cause element is actually discrete from the three prongs under the restatement. The restatement has three avenues for relief that they need to establish. We talked about that, that's the reliance piece, that's the increasing the risk of harm piece, or that's the assuming a duty owed by a third party to the plaintiff. If that is not encompassed in an instruction that just says you gotta find someone contributory negligent and that they were a proximate cause, it omits the restatement prongs. And I say that, Judge, because it makes sense. You see in the Kellerman case, you see in lots of assumed duty cases where the court has emphasized proximate cause still exists in the assumed duty context. But it's not the whole story. So like, for example, even if the evidence established that, there was an express representation made and it led to an increase in the risk of harm, if an earthquake erupted, shook the school, and forced that child to accidentally discharge the firearm and it hit Abby's Warner. Of course, that seems like an improbable circumstance, but that would mean that that prong, that increasing the risk of the harm, was not the proximate cause of the injury. So all I'm saying, Judge, is that these are discrete elements. It would be incomplete just to say grossly negligent and proximate cause. You gotta go into some detail. The other feature of this, Judge, is that by breaking it up element by element, I understand that can be cumbersome, but it also reminds the jury of what is required to be proven here. And a jury, unless they're properly instructed, may conflate. It's common sense, it's intuitive to a lawyer to say, yeah, when they're saying grossly negligent, I understand that's one element that goes to the breach, but it can also be used more broadly to mean the whole shebang, all the elements. But here, that is not made clear in these instructions. So I would contend, Judge, if you elected to forego our more detailed instruction, then I would say at a minimum that we please include some additional language elsewhere in these instructions reminding the jury that these are the discrete elements that need to be established. You cannot have a verdict without them.
Do you have any other response?
Just the fact that we're arguing the entire case as it relates to instructions, as it relates to instruction A,
right,
tells us that it's attempting to do much more than it's supposed to do. It's just supposed to say, this is what they have to prove, this is what they have to prove, and you have to decide those issues based upon the law and the facts as I instruct them to you. That's what the first sentence says. The law contained in all of these instructions. So you're telling them, I'm going to instruct you on all this stuff. But you don't have to cram it all into chapter one.
But your proffer does not include the contrib, right?
It does not.
Which would be three and four.
In other words, if Your Honor thinks that it's appropriate to instruct the jury on contrib, then so be it. You know, we object to that issue. We don't think that there has been evidence, even a scintilla of evidence, to demonstrate that she acted contrary to what a reasonable person would do under the circumstance. But if Your Honor rejects that, we want to make sure that that's rejected in terms of the proffered version. And then if we have to make revision, we could make revision and add 3-4, and then it would effectively say on the issues, on issues 1 and 2, the plaintiff has the burden. On issues 3 and 4, the defendant has the burden.
Right, so you don't actually have an objection to the actual law or issues that are cited in there. You just are more objecting to the presentation.
Both. I object to the law, but I certainly object to the presentation of it all contained in a single instruction, because it also, the fact that it's cumbersome for us to have this argument on the law when it's all packed into one paragraph demonstrates that it's going to be very cumbersome for the jury to understand it, and then they're going to be forced to compare an abbreviated statement of the law in instruction A to a more explanatory statement in, let's say, hypothetical instruction H, and then we're going to get a question from the jury to say, well, which one do we follow, instruction A or instruction H?
Right. All right, so yeah, I think instruction A is cumbersome and includes too much, but I'm not saying that the case law is wrong. So I think we need to take, and I think almost all of these issues are brought up again in other places. So I'm not ruling it that it can't be brought up in other places if it's a correct statement of the law. I just think the model better sets forth from the beginning what the jury is going to be looking at. So I'm going to... we're going to use the model instruction, whatever, after my ruling on the contrib into points 3 and 4, but I want it to look like model jury instruction 3.0 to start off.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, instruction B. Was there any competing offer from the plaintiff? I did not see one.
Correct. There's no competing instruction. We object with the applicability of the law in this context. Your Honor, the instruction reads, a legal duty to protect another from an intentional or criminal conduct by a third person. This is an issue that we've briefed, sort of in motions in limine in some part, but then also have raised in oral argument, which is this instruction is appropriate in contexts in which the conduct of the third, in this case JT, was intentional or criminal. And the issue here is JT, at age 6, is legally incapable of intentional or criminal conduct. He's incapable of it. Under Virginia law, and both the VMJI talking about contrib.
And this isn't a third party case. All right, so your argument is not applicable.
Not applicable.
Okay. All right, you have a response to that?
Yes, Judge Tufel. First, I would highlight and emphasize for the court that the case law, when it applies the assumed duty doctrine to the third party criminal harm or intentional conduct context, that is the line of authority that requires the express undertaking. The reason why there's an express undertaking required is not the touchstone of that analysis and the reason for requiring that it be expressed versus implied, like in other negligence contexts, is not because it's criminal, is not because it's intentional. It doesn't hinge on whether the criminal, the agent, the perpetrator of the act has agency to commit it or not, or can be held liable under the law. The crux is foreseeability. And usually intentional acts or criminal acts by a third party are not foreseeable as a matter of law. I would emphasize that this cuts against opposing counsel's argument. I would argue that the fact that under the law, a minor, 6-year-old child, who cannot form criminal mens rea, and also cannot be held liable held negligent. That emphasizes and underscores the lack of foreseeability here. It's even more unforeseeable that this type of shooting would happen where this person can't even be held liable under the law. That is all the more reason why an express undertaking should be required. And I'm highlighting that, Judge, because that's really the aim behind trying to draw this distinction. If plaintiff can establish that this is outside the realm of third-party criminal harm or intentional conduct, they think they can circumvent this requirement that it should be an express undertaking. And then you get into the implied conduct territory. There's no basis for that in the law, Judge. There's no case law that's done that before. In fact, they've emphasized it turns on foreseeability, where stuff is unforeseeable as a matter of law generally, it's got to be express. And that's what this is getting at. Here, if there's any issue with the phrasing, characterizing this act as criminal or intentional, I can simply rephrase it to third-party harm. And it is a third-party case. The child is a non-party, but it is they use the term party not in the legal sense of someone who's party to a case or action or litigation, but an individual. And here, this is third-party harm. So we can just rephrase. I can eliminate references to criminal harm or intentional, but the doctrine and principles stand. It's got to be expressed.
All right, would you still object striking the first sentence so that it would just begin, the fact that a person realizes or should realize that action on her part is necessary for another's protection does not of itself impose upon her a duty to take such action. That's from the Restatement of Torts, right?
It is, but it's Restatement of Torts 314, and that's exactly what they're citing to. And if we're going, and if the duty, as Burns v. Gagnon talks about, is 324A, then we're effectively giving them an instruction of law that isn't the duty that's been alleged. And then what do they do with it? None of these cases, the Kellerman duty, not at issue. The Terry versus Irish Flea duty, not at issue. The AH versus Church and God in Christ, not at issue. Restatement second, torts, 314, not at issue. What is at issue is the proffered instruction that we provided, which that is almost verbatim to 324A. So in that case, if you want to look at that as a comparative here, but when we talk about these cases, my concern here is if the language that says, what we would have to do is make sure that that law is not contradictory to the law of 324A. And the cases, all of these cases that have analyzed these issues, don't view them the same way. When you interpret the Restatement 314, you interpret Restatement 314, and Restatement 314 is in the context of controlling criminal intentional behavior. 324A is in a different portion of the restatement that talks about assumed duties of care.
All right, so let's go to the third sentence then. A person may voluntarily assume a legal duty to protect another from third-party conduct, even though that duty does not otherwise exist. That's a correct statement of the law, too, correct?
It is a correct statement of the law. Again, when we talk about third-party conduct, that's where we have issue. All
right. More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender, juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location. Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location. Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.